Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Soshi Talks, a regular monthly feature. This week, we'll hear an excerpt from Dr. Max Adrian's talk on the forgotten page from Haiti's history. We've got several road trips to tell you about, and Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. Up first, joining me in studio, Kay Reimers, producer of Our Town, which will appear at the First Presbyterian Church in Yellow Springs in June. We'll give you those dates coming up. And also the director, Lori Sparrow. Ladies, welcome to the studio.
Good morning,
Thank
Jerry.
You, Jerry.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And let's talk about Our Town. It's a classic.
It is a classic. It was first produced in 1938 or 37, sorry, 37 by Thornton Wilder. And it's amazing. We were just saying the other day in rehearsals that the script holds up so well after 75 years. It really is as current as the day it was written, strangely enough. I think a lot of people think that it's a backwards looking piece, perhaps a nostalgic piece. But the truth is, it's really not. It just kind of shows us that all the things that we talk about in our press today, all of the issues that are out there today, we've been dealing with for a really, really, really long time, that humanity is a bit cyclical in the things that we struggle with. And it just makes you think, as Mr. Wilder brings up in his play, people in Babylon were coming home and the smoke was going up the chimney and they were living and working. And they probably were dealing with the same issues that we're dealing with now. That there are some things that are eternal to humanity. And this play really brings that out very, very well. It's a powerhouse.
And let's talk about the decision to do this particular play.
Well, it's funny because it seems like one of those plays that everyone read in high school. And when they read it in high school, they thought, oh, it's boring, nothing happens. And then you have your life experiences and you get older and then you go back and you reread it and you realize that far from nothing happening, actually everything is happening. And it is about life being a series of small incidents that create a larger action in your life. And I think that that really, when I reread it, I thought, oh, yeah, there's depths to this that you don't get sometimes when you're really, really young.
We come to it too early in life. This is a play that we really come to too early in life. And you do read it, and you're like, because the first act is called A Day in the Life, you know, the daily life. And the second act is Love and Marriage. And then the third act is a little heavier, for those of you who remember Our Town. As the stage manager says, we have another act coming, and I suppose you can guess what that's about. But the thing is that when you read it when you're young or you study it in college or you read it at kind of the beginning of life, beginning of going out on your journey into the world, when you come back to it, when Kay had told me about it last October when we were doing the 10-minute play series mm-hmm. that Center Stage did, that wonderful series, by the way. That was mm-hmm. so much fun. And she had said, you know, what about Our Town? And I went, wow, Yellow Springs and Our Town. That would be fantastic. I mean, what a symmetry. Thinking to myself, I haven't picked up this play in 15 years, you know. So, and I'm just thinking, well, yeah, that would work. And we had all these different ideas. And then I picked up the script and I read it. And it was like, I was doing a show in Dayton and I had gotten home and I said, okay, I'm going to read it. And I picked it up and I read it and it was 1 a.m. and I was laying in bed crying. It was so powerful. I mean, just like, and I was like, what's going on with this play? But I do think that you have to, I think that you have to know what it's like to love somebody, to fall in love. I think you have to know what it's like to hold a baby that is somehow yours, whether it's actually your baby or not, or whether it's your family's baby, or I think you have to bury somebody. I do. I think that you have to experience loss of some kind. And then this play takes on a whole new meaning. And again, what better place to do it than Yellow Springs?
You talk about that matchup. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing in Yellow Springs with the community theater that you're essentially bringing back to the area.
Yellow Springs, Ohio has a tremendous history of theater. I mean, it starts way back, but it's not just Center Stage. There was Shakespeare Under the Stars at Antioch, which was a much bigger deal than most people remember, the original with Meredith Dallas and Arthur Lithgow and, Ellis Rabb. And, I mean, they They did the entire canon of Shakespeare in 5 years, partnered with the Cleveland Zoo, brought in New York actors, I mean, intensely. And then from there, Arthur Lithgow went and founded Great Lakes. So, Kay, you should talk more about what's going on with Center Stage and how that came about, because I'm just so grateful she brought it back.
Well, actually, I think one nice thing about bringing back Center Stage is I think people get intimidated with the idea of doing an arts project or doing an arts event, and you think that you have to write a grant and you have to get a lot of money and then you have to hire professionals and then you have to be told what to do. But if you really truly have a love for something, sometimes it gets very, very simple. We were just talking about Free Shakespeare with Jerry, and that's basically just people performing Shakespeare on street corners and in parks and wherever they can get some space. And it's doing a marvelous job, and I'd like people to realize if you do have a love for art, you can, you know, if you really pursue it, you will be finding people who are willing to pursue it with you. And that's what we found here. And it's not just me. It's just a lot of people. And that's what, yeah, I'm very grateful for.
And we're very grateful to the Presbyterian Church in particular, because they are very generous with their space, with their donation of space. They have been very supportive of the art community that I can see. So I want to give them a huge shout out, because that's a nice little center of arts that is coming out right in the middle of downtown. And it's just a lovely facility to have.
This performance of Our Town is, of course, a benefit to enhance theater productions here in Yellow Springs. Let's
Correct.
Talk about that.
Well, all proceeds, because we don't really have budgets, all proceeds that are raised go back into the budget for the next show. And I know that Kay is already thinking about next shows and what wants to be done. There is definitely things that happen throughout the year. Winter productions, the 10-minute play festival. Next year, we are looking already at doing something in the summer space and looking for spaces that might be a little more air conditioned than the one we have now.
just bring a fan.
Bring a fan. Wear comfortable clothes. It'll be fine. We will cool the space. So all the proceeds go back into the budget to do this. We are very much a community effort. This is a labor of love for everyone involved, and any money we make goes directly back into the next thing that will be done.
Kay Reimers, producer, and Lori Sparrow, director. Our Town will be performed at the First Presbyterian Church in Yellow Springs June 22nd and 23rd, and the 29th and 30th. Those are both Friday and Saturday nights. Doors open at 7:15, and performance kicks off at 8 o'clock. Ladies, good luck with the production, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Jerry. We really appreciate the opportunity.
And I do want to add that we will have live music
from
7:15 to 8 o'clock. They have live musicians, so come early and listen to the concert first.
Ladies, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jerry.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for listening in your town. Each week on WISO Weekend, we take you on a road trip as part of the New Ohio Guide. You can download and take these trips for yourself. Today, producer Sandra Slide Brennan takes us to East Liverpool.
East Liverpool is a pottery capital of the United States. It's been the capital since the 1880s. Sarah Webster Vaudrey is the director of the East Liverpool Museum of Ceramics. She showed me around.
And water holders and
doorknobs and inkwells and piggy banks and pie pans. Yeah, it was very utilitarian at first, and then as time went on, people were able to combine utility with beauty, the human impulses. Let's make it attractive as well as useful.
Hundreds of potteries operated here. There are a couple of reasons why. The first is transportation. It's right on the Ohio River. And when the pottery started in the mid-1800s, the thousands of settlers moving west needed things that were made out of pottery.
There was a guy named James Bennett who came from Staffordshire, England, in 1839. We give him credit for being the father of our pottery industry because he was the first English-trained potter to come to East Liverpool.
One reason East Liverpool is the crockery capital is its natural abundance of clay. That drew immigrant potters here.
And he wrote to his brothers in Derbyshire and Staffordshire, come on over here, let's do this together. So the Bennett brothers' pottery existed. They wrote back to Staffordshire and Derbyshire, come give this a try.
I am descended from a long line of English potters. as is everyone else in this community.
Betsy Chenwind grew up in East Liverpool and worked at Hall China, one of the last potteries in East Liverpool.
95% of the people here are from England and from the same part of England, which is what's amazing. Stoke, everyone is from Stoke. And people from Stoke come to visit and they say, gee, I just feel like I haven't left home. The mannerisms are the same. The streets are the same. The names are the same.
Many of the potteries here were family owned and operated. Betsy showed me how it worked. There's a display in the museum.
There's the Jiggerman.
Okay.
And we think of him as dad, and that's mom, and here are the two kids.
In the earliest years, it was a husband and wife, but a few kids. And
other than there's mechanization, the ware is made pretty much the same way.
It went from ma and pa operations to bigger and bigger, and then by the time the jigger machine came along in the 1870s, I believe, moved it into the era of mass production.
Pottery making became a part of the community in other ways, too.
We had Potters Bank and Trust. Every single sports team coming out of East Liverpool school system has the word Potters in it.
Pottery even influenced the creation of the official town game.
We made more doorknobs here than anywhere else in the country. And of course, when you're making that many, there are going to be ones that don't come out well.
But the East Liverpoolians found a use for them.
Eventually, somebody thought, hey, a doorknob is like a ball. Let's make a game out of this.
Doorknob tossing, the official game of East Liverpool, is played annually in June at their pottery festival. The Museum of Ceramics is open year-round. From East Liverpool, Ohio, I'm Sandra Sleit-Brennan.
To download this tour and explore it on your own, visit seeohiofirst.org and click on the New Ohio Guide. The New Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Presidential hopeful Mitt Romney is on a road trip as part of his campaign. He'll be in Troy today. WISO's Emily McCord spoke with Marcia Ryan, the owner of Kay's Hamburger Shop, where Romney will be stopping by.
It's exciting, but it's like preparing for a wedding, and you're so nervous that day that everything go well that you don't realize yet what a good time you had till you look at the pictures. It's almost kind of a carnival atmosphere because the customers are excited.
So, I mean, do you have to order a bunch of extra hamburgers? Or
I ordered extra everything because we aren't normally open on Sunday. What I understand is Romney's traveling with his grandchildren, and his grandchildren told him there better be a stop with hamburgers, fries, and shakes.
This isn't the first time a major politician has visited you guys.
No, that's true. That's true. And we've been very fortunate. My parents started this during the Depression, 1935. This is our 77th year in business. We still grind our own beef. We're just a mom-and-pop business that has survived. You know, before we've had people in, but no one... Well, we had Quayle when he was a sitting vice president. And that was neat. But... You just worry every time that you don't want to be the one to do something wrong. And I don't want to be.
I would imagine that there is an element of stress that you don't normally have as you head in towards a weekend.
Since I'm not normally open on Sunday, I had to have the air conditioner guy come in and set. We have four air conditioners, and one of them, for the public, is set to go and not be on Sunday. Because there's no one here, and I had to call him and have him come in and reprogram it because it's going to be hot, and I didn't want the only story they got out was Romney sweats.
As a small business owner, how often do you dip your toe in politics? Is that something you usually talk about, or is this sort of a special occasion?
I grew up at a family that even though we had a restaurant, eight around the table together, and we discuss politics, God, and business. So I feel very strongly about this. So, yes, I've always been interested in politics, and I didn't realize until I was grown that my upbringing was different than most. Most people don't talk about God. They don't talk about politics, and they don't talk about business. And those are the three things that interest me. So, you know, it's just kind of different, that's all.
No, it's funny. It's one of those things when you go to Thanksgiving, they say, okay, just make sure we don't talk about politics and religion, and we'll get through
it
just fine.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'll have to eat everything on the table.
Well, Marcia, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. You've been very kind.
This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. So She Talks is a way of enlightening the world with local knowledge. Today in our monthly feature, Dr. Max Adrian pulls a page from Haiti's forgotten history. Here's an excerpt.
Since the native Haitians have not found many pages in the history book and many advocates in the lesson plans and classrooms, in the name of humanity, let us look back very briefly at their misfortune, as they and the pre-Columbian Haiti have become the forgotten firstborn children. Haiti's worst day. On December 5, 1492, after having discovered San Salvador, Santa Maria de la Concepcion, Ferdinanda, Isabella in Cuba, Christopher Columbus saw from afar some extremely tall mountains of a new island. The Indians from Cuba that he had with him all cried together, Haiti, Boyo, Kiskeya, which means land of tall mountains. In Indian, Boyo means house, and overall, land of tall mountain with a lot of houses. On December 6, Columbus stopped at a small port which he named St. Nicholas because it was St. Nicholas's Day. On December 12, 1492, in the name of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, he took possession of the whole island of Haiti, which reminds him of the coast of Andalusia. He therefore called the island Hispaniola, or as we know it today, Hispaniola, which means small Spain. According to Aimé Césaire, Victor Schœlcher, a 19th century French historian, is Haiti's best historian. And according to Victor Schœlcher and many other historians, unlike the bellicose, cruel, and savage Caribs of the pre-Columbian West Indian region, the Haitian Indians were a peaceful race. This is how Columbus in his journal described them to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. These Indians, they are so loving, so sweet, so peaceful that I can assure you, your majesties, that there exists nowhere in the universe a better race nor a better country. They love their neighbors like themselves. Their words, their language are so gracious and affable. They are always smiling. Although they are naked, but their manners are full of grace, decency, and candor. Las Casas, besides Columbus, perhaps the worst person to have ever set foot in Haiti, described the Haitian Indians this way. These Indians seem to live in the primitive innocence of Adam and Eve before they fell from grace. Furthermore, in a letter to Don Luis San Angel, the Minister of Finances, Columbus said this about the Haitian Indians. They gave so generously all their possession that one has to see it in order to believe it. If you ask them something, they would never say no and would give it to you right away. I don't believe that they understood the difference between mine and yours. I believe they share everything, especially when it comes to food. Moreover, in his book entitled Colonies étrangères et Haïti, I translate foreign colonies and Haiti, Victor Schœlcher depicts the Haitian Indians this way. These Indians barely know the difference between mine and yours. They were calm, happy, good, and their days are sweet leisure. They spent their entire lives laid down under nice and sweet shades. The true innocence, peace, and happiness are the poets of yesteryear described to us. Such was the people of the pre-Columbian Haiti destined to die very soon in the excess of slavery, forced labor that civilization was going to condemn them to endure by forcing them to cultivate sugarcane. Unfortunately for these friendly and innocent Haitian Indians, they viewed and trusted the Spaniard as some new friends that will help them fight against the cannibal Caribs who often raid their villages and take their wives and children. So within 10 days of his arrival, they helped Columbus build a small fortress, which is the first European edifice in the Americas. Columbus called this edifice La Natividad. Etymologically speaking, La Natividad from Latin literally means birth. In hindsight, one can say it was the birth, the genesis, the seed of the future extermination of the Haitian Indians. 12 years after his arrival, it is estimated that 1 million Haitian Indians died of violence, slavery, and the trade at the hands of the Spaniards. It is also estimated that there were about 5 million Haitian Indians when Columbus arrived. 50 years after his arrival, Las Casas estimated that there were only about 200 Haitian Indians left on the island. Las Casas further estimated that more than 15 million Haitian Indians died during the occupation of the Spaniard. Well, Haitian Indians were completely exterminated, wiped out, total genocide by slavery, forced labor, human trafficking, smallpox, and also disrespect for human rights. Yes, Haiti was nice, rich, exploited, violated, disgraced, and sacrificed on the altar of religion and greed. Today, all we hear is that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. No one seems to be interested in looking at the roots of Haiti's all ills. Where did it all begin? When the Haitian Indians were on the verge of extermination, and to continue their onslaught, Las Casas suggested to Ferdinand and Isabella to bring African from Guyana to repopulate the island and to work as slaves. Such was the fate of the Haitian Indians, a missing page or a forgotten page in the saga of the Western Hemisphere. Today, in the classrooms, in the newspapers, even sometimes from the preachers, you don't hear such a horrible beginning. you don't hear about the total destruction of a people. All you hear about the imported Haitians, the African slaves. It would be nice to take a look back about the service that also Haiti also rendered to the Americas. The first black republic country in the world, the first country to say no to slavery, the first country where the civil rights movement, the human rights movement, began in the Americas. Thank you.
Dr. Max Adrian, you can hear the full speech at SOCHE.org. This is WISO Weekend.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. This week, Ohio was indeed the battleground state. Both President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney campaigned here. Today, I'm joined by Jessica Werman. She's the Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, and she also reports for the Dayton Daily News. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ohio is always considered an important state during presidential elections. Is there anything special about this year?
No, you know, it's not exactly news that Ohio is a swing state. It is always a swing state. In fact, I was at an interview with Senator Portman yesterday, and he referred to it as sort of a purple state. You know, I mean, it's such a microcosm of the country that you can't really reliably call it a red state or a blue state. It just can go, it really can go either way, and that's why it's such a pivotal state for this election.
So we had President Obama in Cleveland. What is the message that he's trying to sell Ohioans?
Well, you know, the fight this year is over, and, you know, it's kind of deja vu all over again. It's about the economy, and it's about how to make it recover, to what degree it has recovered, that sort of thing. You know, and that's basically the theme that both of these candidates want to hammer home, is that they are the guy to improve the economy. But here's where it gets a little bit tricky. The national unemployment rate is 8.2%, give or take, and it's 7.4% in Ohio, so it's a little bit better than the national average. It's still not great, and I don't think that there's anybody who is in this view, is in your listening audience, who doesn't know somebody who is struggling to find a job, or maybe just finally got hired, or maybe even dropped out of the workforce for a while altogether. So it's not great, but, you know, they can claim that it is a little bit better than the national average. Now, Obama can make the case that it's indicative of perhaps some sort of recovery attributable to his administration. He can and has pointed to the auto bailout as an example of a policy that perhaps has helped to spur Ohio's recovery. Now, Republicans, meanwhile, say, you know, they will concede that maybe the state is doing a little bit better, but they credit the policies of Ohio Governor John Kasich, who's a Republican, with helping to bring Ohio back.
What about Mitt Romney? He was here campaigning as well. It sounds like he's also focusing on sort of small rural towns, and at least he is in this current bus tour.
He is. Now, he was in Cincinnati. It's interesting because it seemed, anecdotally speaking, that you always see Obama in Cleveland, where there is sort of a strong Democratic base, and then you see Romney more often in Republican areas such as Cincinnati, where there's also a huge Republican donor base. Now, he's going to these smaller towns this week, Troy and Newark, and he's also going to be hammering home the message that because that his experience as governor of Massachusetts and his experience in the private sector mean he's the guy who can fix the economy.
Now, the latest polls have been showing a tight race here in Ohio. Do we expect it to stay that way throughout the election cycle?
I don't see any indicators that it will change. You see polls that sort of look both ways on this. And then, you know, you also have another little factor here, which is the fact that Senator Rob Portman is considered by many to be a shortlist contender for the vice presidential spot for Mitt Romney. So that's the other thing that might be a factor in Ohio. You know, who gets picked for this vice presidential slot? Does it matter? Does it make a difference? I mean, will it bring the swing state over the edge? You know, it's kind of hard to tell at this point. And again, you really do have such a microcosm in Ohio. You've got rural communities, you've got urban communities, you've got a manufacturing base. I mean, you name it, it's in Ohio. The other interesting thing is that I was looking today and I was trying to figure out how many times either Governor Romney or Obama or President Obama or the Vice President have been in Ohio so far this year. This is not counting Newt Gingrich or Santorum or any of the other Republican, or the earlier Republican contenders, 19 times so far. So
I expect we'll be seeing more stops from both the president and Mitt Romney as November draws closer.
I think that maybe it would be wise for them to consider rental property to stay in, since they're spending so much time in the state.
I've been speaking with Jessica Werman. She is a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch in Washington. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next, The Book Nook.